The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue and Rookie Magazine. The first article will be from Teen Vogue's OG History series, where we unearth history not told through a white, cis-hetero-patriarchal lens. And this week's article from that series is titled, Feminist Activist Bella Abzug Paved the Way for Women Politicians. And this is by Peter Dreyer, published July 24th, 2020. This woman's place is in the House of Representatives, declared Bella Savitsky Abzug when she launched her campaign for Congress in 1970. It was a typical Abzug quote, combining colorful wit with an attack on an injustice, the lack of women in elected office. A database of women in Congress by the Rutgers Eagleton Institute of Politics Center for American Women in Politics is revealing on this front. When Abzug first took office in 1971, there were only 13 women in the House. By the time she left in 1977, she was one of 18 women in that chamber. Today, there are 101. When she ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate from New York in 1976, there were no women in the Senate. Today, there are 26. Abzug was a precursor to several current members of Congress, including John Lewis, Jan Schakowsky, Karen Bass, Raul Grijalva, Pramila Jayapal, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who began their careers as organizers and still use those skills to give a voice to and help represent the people left out of the political process. New generations of Americans may have been introduced to Abzug recently, thanks to the 9-part miniseries Mrs. America, which featured 3-time Emmy-winning actor Margot Martindale as Battling Bella, as Abzug was known. The show depicted Abzug as one of the key feminist agitators of the 1970s, who went to battle with conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly over the Equal Rights Amendment. Abzug spent most of her career as an agitator for civil rights, unions, peace, and women's equality. But after she arrived on Capitol Hill, she had to balance her role as both a pioneering congresswoman, an insider, with her instincts and talents as a defiant organizer and activist, an outsider. As part of the women's rights movement, Abzug and other feminist leaders, including Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, Representative Shirley Chisholm, Jill Ruckelshaus, Florence, who, quote, nicknamed Flo Kennedy, and Midge Constanza, debated how to balance their principled views and pragmatic goals of persuading the Democratic Party to adopt women's rights positions in its official platform. These conversations took place in the early 1970s, before same-sex marriage was legal and sexual harassment and rape were mainstream public issues, so advocacy for these topics was viewed as radical by most Americans. As a pragmatic politician, Abzug was used to making compromises and calculating trade-offs to win legislative victories that improved people's lives. She was often the broker between different factions within the women's movement, mentoring fellow feminists about when to push for one-step-at-a-time reforms and when to pursue overthrow the patriarchy revolution. She spent her adult life walking that tightrope. Abzug was born to Russian Jewish immigrants in New York City in 1920, the same year that women won the right to vote. Her father, a World War I pacifist, ran a butcher shop, which, after the onset of World War I, he renamed the Live and Let Live Meat Market. He died when Abzug was 13. Her family's Orthodox synagogue forbade women to recite the mourner's Kaddish, the morning prayer, a duty traditionally reserved for males 13 and over, but Abzug went to the synagogue every day for a year and recited the prayer anyway. According to Alan H. Levy's book, The Political Life of Bella Abzug, 1920 to 1976, she later recalled, "I stood apart in the corner. The men scowled at me, but no one stopped me. It was those mornings that taught me you could do unconventional things." Her Jewish upbringing gave her a strong sense of outrage against anti-Semitism, discrimination against women, and other forms of injustice. According to Suzanne Braun Levine and Mary Tom's oral history and biography of Abzug, titled Bella Abzug, How One Tough Broad from the Bronx Fought Jim Crow and Joe McCarthy, Pissed Off Jimmy Carter, Battled for the Rights of Women and Workers, Rallied Against War and for the Planet, and Shook Up Politics Along the Way. That is a very long title of a biography. She was elected senior class president at the all-girls Walton School and graduated during the Depression in 1938. As president of Hunter College's Student Council and a leader of the Radical American Student Union, she led demonstrations against Nazism and fascism in Europe. She supported the unionization of the college's staff, pushed to introduce African American and Jewish history courses into the curriculum, and challenged the firing of faculty members accused of radicalism. After college, she applied to law schools and won a scholarship to Columbia University Law School. Abzug interrupted her law school education to work in the shipbuilding factory during World War II. She was one of only 7 women out of 120 students in her class at Columbia, but nevertheless managed to become an editor of the Columbia Law Review and graduated in 1944. The history of the feminist movement is often told with the first wave of women suffrage activists from 1848 to 1920, fighting for the right to vote, and then the rise of second wave feminism beginning in the 1960s, expanding the agenda of women's political issues. It is well known that many of the leading first wave feminists had roots in the abolition movement against slavery. But often overlooked is the fact that many of the leading figures of that second wave, including Abzug, Betty Friedan, Ella Baker, Esther Peterson, Gerda Lerner, Pauli Murray, Aline Hernandez, and others, had engaged in what is called the woman question, particularly the concerns of working class and black women in the 1940s and 1950s, through their involvement in the socialist, communist, and labor union organizations. In college, law school, and afterward, Abzug traveled in these left-wing circles. For years, she was the subject of FBI surveillance. In a secret memo, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover even called her, quote, dangerous. These political views and social ties led Abzug, after law school, to join a progressive firm that represented workers and their unions. She took cases that challenged the twin evils of Jim Crow racism and Cold War McCarthyism. Yet, even in her progressive law firm, Abzug faced constant sexism. As detailed by Leandra Zarno in the journal Law and Social Inquiry, one of the firm's partners even insisted that Abzug carry his briefcase to court. She never learned how to type because, according to Braun Levine and Tom's book, she once explained, "If I knew how, the lawyers would have always asked me to type things, and I just decided I was not going to learn how to type." Early in their marriage, her husband, Martin, typed her legal briefs. Although Abzug was hardly shy, she realized that some of the union leaders and other lawyers paid less attention to her than the male attorneys. So she decided to wear wide-brimmed hats, which drew notice and soon became her trademark. Abzug achieved notoriety for her defense of Willie McGee, a black man who was falsely accused of raping a white woman in Mississippi and sentenced to death in a 1945 trial. Abzug was hired by the left-wing Civil Rights Congress to help with McGee's appeals and was 8 months pregnant when she traveled to the Mongolia state in 1951 to argue his case to the court. I'm sorry, Magnolia State. I apologize. As a white Jewish radical female lawyer from New York, she was attacked by white supremacists and local newspapers, including the Jackson Daily News, which wrote, as Abzug retold it, that she should burn Willie McGee's white woman lawyer along with him in the electric chair. According to Bron Levine and Tom's book, when Abzug arrived in Jackson, the hotel where she had made a reservation claimed not to have a reservation on the books and sent her away. Other hotels also refused to give her a room, so she wound up spending the night in the city's bus station. In court, she argued that McGee's civil rights had been denied because black Americans could not serve on juries and an all-white jury had convicted him after 2.5 minutes of deliberation. Unlike the male lawyers who represented McGee in three previous trials, Abzug argued that her client's sexual relationship with his white accuser was consensual, which focused attention on the social taboo of interracial sexual relations. In doing so, she challenged the racist practice of applying the death sentence for rape convictions only in the case of black defendants. The case became a cause of celebration among liberals and leftists in the United States and internationally. Despite the best efforts of Abzug and other attorneys, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the case. McGee was executed in an electric chair in May 1951. His execution was broadcast live on local radio. The strain involved in that case caused Abzug to have a miscarriage. In the 1950s, the heart of the McCarthy era, Abzug was one of the few attorneys willing to represent people unfairly accused of being members of or having close ties to the Communist Party. Her clients included actors, school teachers, and public figures, such as folk singer Pete Seeger, and they were dragged before congressional committees and blacklisted for their radical beliefs and affiliations. While breaking new ground as a trial lawyer, Abzug also became involved in the peace movement. In 1961, she helped organize the Women's Strike for Peace, which, at the height of the Cold War, opposed the arms race and nuclear testing. The group later became a key part of the anti-Vietnam War movement. Abzug viewed the arms race, racial discrimination, welfare rights, equal job opportunities, and Social Security, along with gay rights, as women's issues. As a feminist activist, she recognized the untapped potential of women as a progressive voting bloc and as elected officials. In 1970, at age 50, Abzug ran for office for the first time, vying for the congressional seat in a district in Manhattan's West Side. Running as an anti-war, pro-feminist candidate, she defeated the 7-term incumbent Leonard Farbstein in the Democratic primary, then beat the Republican candidate, popular radio talk show host Barry Farber, in the general election. During her 3 terms in Congress, Abzug was candid, fearless, and quotable, while still wearing her flamboyant hats. She was always well prepared on the issues and was a genius of parliamentary tactics. Ignoring traditions in which new members of Congress typically worked below the radar, her first day on the Hill, she introduced legislation demanding the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Vietnam. She also introduced a bill to end the draft. Abzug met with anti-war activists regularly to strategize, and her activism earned her a place on President Richard Nixon's infamous enemies list. Other highlights of Abzug's tenure in Congress include introducing the first LGBTQ rights legislation, co-authoring the Water Pollution Act of 1972, now known as the Clean Water Act, introducing the Equal Credit Opportunity Act in 1973, which gave women greater access to consumer credit, and chairing the Subcommittee on Government, Information, and Individual Rights that produced the Sunshine Laws, which required government hearings to be held in public. To top it off, she was one of the first members of Congress to call for Nixon's impeachment during the Watergate scandal. Abzug always gave credit to her husband, Martin, whom she married in 1944, and they raised two children, for his willingness to share housework, allowing her to become a busy public figure. In a 1984 interview, she called him a role model feminist husband. In 1976, Abzug gave up her House seat to run for the Senate, losing in the Democratic primary to Daniel P. Moynihan. Despite suffering from health problems, including breast cancer, Abzug remained active after leaving Congress. In 1979, she founded the nonprofit political action group Women USA, and later published the book Gender Gap, Bella Abzug's Guide to Political Power for American Women. She became a leader of the International Women's Movement, galvanizing efforts to push the United Nations to pay more attention to women and their concerns about human rights, economic justice, militarism, and the environment. In 1991, she founded the Women's Environment and Development Organization to inject women's issues into discussions about climate change and sustainable development. This is the time to declare, as we approach the great millennium, that women must be made free, Abzug said in a speech to the UN Commission on the Status of Women on March 16, 1998. We cannot be free as long as our human rights are violated, as long as we don't have economic equality, and as long as we are not participating in gender-balanced political bodies. It was her last public speech. She died 2 weeks later. At a memorial service celebrating her life, Geraldine Ferraro, another congresswoman from New York, summarized Abzug's legacy. Let's be honest about it. She didn't knock lightly on the door. She didn't even push it open or batter it down. She took it off the hinges forever, so that those of us who came after could walk through. And now we're going to switch gears to a Rookie Magazine article titled, You're Not a Garbage Person and Other Pep Talks. This is by Anne Donahue and was published on August 24th, 2018. Being a human can be the worst. We're messy, we're flawed, and we're ever-changing works in progress who can't stop making the same mistakes. We're emotional, irrational, and passive-aggressive. And more than a few of us have started years-long feuds based on a friend's response to news we've texted them. But yet, despite knowing all of this, we assume that we're alone in our missteps and compare ourselves to anybody who seems to excel where we can't. All of this makes us even harder on ourselves, despite an important universal truth. No one has it all figured out, and at no point do we stop growing. Obviously, it can be next to impossible to remember this in the wake of a personal disaster. So that's why I prepared this necessary pep talk for the next time you find yourself spinning your traits or your choices into a lot of negatives. Number one, you are the sum of your parts. Meaning, you're not defined only by the less flattering ones. Earlier this year, in the midst of a particularly difficult time, I sat across from my therapist and began describing myself as diabolical and manipulative and any other synonym for, well, bad, which she was not having. She reminded me of the good things about my capacity for overthinking. I could analyze well, problem solve, and act politically in social situations I wanted to lash out in, but for whatever reason, I couldn't. And then she also reminded me that on top of these traits I'd already listed, I was much more. Rarely is anybody good, bad, or definable by those concrete terms. who we are is a result of how we grew up, who we grew up with, the lessons we learned and took with us, and the ways we've learned to cope. Sure, some of us may use less than wonderful ways to self-preserve, but we balance ourselves out in other ways. You can still be flawed and generous and kind and funny and caring. After all, we're people, not cardboard cutouts of heroes and villains stuck in two-dimensional roles we've resigned ourselves to. Number two, self-discovery can be messy and awful. Few things are as scary as hitting rock bottom and realigning who you are and who you're going to be. But the thing is, it's brave to make painful choices and admit that you need to change. Plus, it's freeing. Since change is the only real constant, we know that being alive means being in motion, and that at some point down the road, we'll find ourselves questioning everything all over again. A lot of us don't like to talk about this process. Why should we? Every time we go through it, I end up crying in my car to the second to last song from the Hamilton soundtrack. It's easy to think that growth means taking a leap forward in a definitive game board direction. But for that leap to make a lasting imprint, it also means having to look back and examine what brought you here. And that's never easy. But it's important. There's a reason so many of us upload photos of ourselves wearing questionable amounts of pleather on hashtag Throwback Thursday. It's interesting to revisit our original stories. While the past still has the habit of resurrecting moments we wish we could leave behind, the messiness of acknowledgement takes a lot of work and willingness to do it. It takes a strong person to decide to deep dive into their worst and greatest hits. So, hello. Self-discovery is not for the weak. Number three, most people are going through the same thing. Nobody's life is perfect. Social media is an illusion, and few people are about to dump their metaphorical bags out on the table and dare you to go through it. As I like to remind myself, and anybody I'm screaming at on the internet, most of us are just trying to pick up lunch without incident. Despite knowing all of this, we keep comparing ourselves to everybody else. So first, stop it. The glimpse we see of other people's lives offer nothing but a locker door's equivalent of reality. We don't know what everyone else is coping with, or what they're trying to undo, or what they're trying to outrun. But we do know that people are changing, growing, and learning like we are. And while I'm not about to suggest being friends with anybody for the sake of "I'm a person too" camaraderie, I'm suggesting we unassign the narratives we've assigned to people who aren't us. We're not alone in our messiness, and we're certainly not the only ones desperately trying to sort through it. Number four, nothing is forever, meaning the feeling won't last. I like to remind myself that most of us don't remember fighting a terrible flu. We remember that we were sick, that it hurt to lay down, that we thought it would be the end of us. But then it wasn't. And now we're mostly unable to recall the specifics of our sickness. Once upon a time, it seemed absolute, and then it went away. This isn't to say being a work in progress or grappling with change or enduring growing pains or struggles that are going to go away. But the pain of those things will lessen, and you will one day find yourself looking back at this particular moment, and you will marvel at the fact that this stage is over. Of course, in moments of anxiety or self-deprecation, or gazing so far inward that we feel defined by our worst traits, it's hard to remember that nothing lasts forever, and that while change is constant, periods of change come to a close. But they do. While none of us will ever stop growing or evolving or using our past to get a better grip on the future, we can remind ourselves that getting through all of it is a feat in itself. The beauty of change is that eventually we'll land on the other side and realize how much we learned and how beautiful it was. So I only have a few minutes left, but there is another series that I just found in Rookie Magazine, which I guess it was a post that talked about back to school. And I know that a lot of our young listeners or teenage listeners are going to be going back to school in the fall, maybe in person, maybe online. We'll see, depending on where you attend school and what your family decides to do. But in that spirit, I think I'll find some articles that are related to going back to school or starting a new school year. And this particular article, which I'll read part of, was titled Advice from Sophomores to High School Freshmen. And this was published in August 26, 2015. But I think some of these pieces of advice will still be very relevant. And let me see, I'll pick this one by Star, who was 15 years old and lived in Pennsylvania. And her advice says, freshman year stands in my memory as one of the most nerve-wracking to enter. I think in most cases, girls don't know what exactly to expect from it. It's the start of high school, which means a new building, new faculty, new kids, and a new you. And that's just the thing. It's a new you. While it's scary being in such a new environment, the best advice I can give you is to adapt the best you can. Realize that your friends are going to change. It can't be helped. But change can be the best thing. It can allow you to shape yourself into who you want to be, not who the people around you expect you to be. I'm sure you've heard people tell you this before, and I can promise you it's important. Try your very best in your academics. This will be the first year you take finals. Save yourself from the stress and get good grades. That way, the grade you get on your finals won't make or break your chances of passing because your year average were a safety net. I can't stress that enough, how important it is to join as many clubs and or sports as you possibly can as well. In the end, freshman year isn't all bad. You can make a lot of new friends and learn so much about life. And that was from Star, who was 15 years old, living in Pennsylvania. And I'll do one more. This is from Emily, age 15, from Michigan. She states, my advice is to be as decent and polite as you can to people, especially your teachers. If your teachers like you, chances are they'll be much more forgiving when grading. Oh, I'm sorry. If your teachers like you, chances are they'll be much more forgiving when grading. Also, never assume the worst about people based on reputation or who they hang out with. You really don't want to be making enemies that early on in high school. Good luck, and you will survive. All right, that's it for today. This is Bahati Mutisia, and I've been reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions, call 919-832-5138.